South Africa is at the epicenter of the AIDS epidemic. More than 10% of the population is infected. 600 people die of AIDS every day there. But until recently, the government has refused to provide access to antiretroviral drugs, challenging the safety and effectiveness of the drugs, and questioning whether AIDS was caused by HIV. My guest, Dr. Eric Gomar, started a pilot project in Khayelitsha, a poor township outside of Cape Town, where his staff provides these drugs to people with AIDS. He hopes to show that the treatment is effective and that people who are poor and uneducated can comply with the drug regimen. Dr. Gomar heads the South African mission of Doctors Without Borders, also known by its French name, Médecins Sans Frontières. He chose Khayelitsha as the location for his clinic because local authorities there had already defied the government by creating a program giving drugs to pregnant women with AIDS to prevent transmitting the virus to their babies. Last year, the magazine Scientific American named Dr. Gomar Medical Policy Leader of the Year. I asked him how AIDS had already affected Khayelitsha when he started his program.
When I first went to Khayelitsha, that was mid-99, I used to go there every day, forcing myself to go. I had no program. There was nothing, strictly nothing, happening around HIV/AIDS, hardly even any test done. Nobody was speaking about it. It was a taboo. You were not meant to speak about it. And my first and strongest enemy were the nurses, in fact, of the health staff, because they were telling me, "No, doctor, sorry, it's impossible to set up an HIV clinic. All people here will never queue in front of your door. You don't imagine the stigma."
Wait, so nurses were telling you don't even bother to set up a clinic because HIV is such a stigma, no one's going to come?
Yes, of course. Nurses were extremely negative about it. They didn't want at all me to open in a clinic because we opened a clinic inside existing day hospitals. So it was a mix of denial, not saying, "No, all people will never, ever queue in front of your door because they are not ready to accept that they are HIV." And something I discovered later, it was also a mix of their own fear. They had the impression, in fact, that I would bring to them a lot of HIV-positive people, and I was telling them, "But they are here around already. They are among your patients. You just do not know that they are HIV-positive."
So was part of what the nurses were afraid of catching the disease themselves because you'd be bringing in more infected people?
Definitely. Contamination was a fear. Mm-hmm. But much worse than that, this terrible stigma around HIV. HIV and AIDS are them. We are health staff. We're all uniform, with all privilege. You see, you try, when you are in a terrible situation, you see the boat sinking, you try to reestablish classes. We are in the Titanic here, and the first class doesn't want to mix with the third class because there's just not enough room on the safety boats. The good success we had, this was beginning of last year, 2002, is that the first nurse came to the clinic, in fact, inside her own clinic where everybody knows her, and begged for help. She's now perfectly well. She's back to work. And she's, of course, our best argument and advocate against stigmatization.
Now, if AIDS was such a stigma in the township where you set up your clinic, how did you convince people who weren't on the medical staff, the greater part of the population, how did you convince them to show up for help if they needed it?
Well, it was very simple. Numbers are killing the stigma. People are desperate to get some form of treatment. They don't want to die. So you always find people who are ready to go. If, of course, in exchange, coming out positive, they receive a service, which was not at all the case before. And then, you know, it builds up, and the number builds up, and suddenly people realize that it's not dozens, it's not hundreds. It's thousands. Only in Khayelitsha, this township, 500,000 inhabitants, we estimate we have between 60 and 70,000 people HIV positive. It's big numbers. They start to, nowadays, you see everywhere in the street people wearing T-shirts HIV positive. It's even fashionable to wear those things. I think numbers make an enormous difference, and numbers bring in a different power balance and force forced acceptation.
One of the things you've had to do at the clinic is to give people drugs, antiretroviral drugs. Those are expensive drugs. Those are drugs that were particularly difficult to come by in South Africa. What has your technique been for getting drugs in an affordable enough way so that you could give them or sell them, you could tell me which it is, to the sick people at your clinic?
Yes, we don't sell them. We give them for free, and we believe it's important they are free. But you are totally right. So it was a very tricky situation. That time, I remember, 99, here in South Africa, it costed $6,000 per year per patient, triple therapy. Okay? There's no way the South African government would have been able to afford it. And from the beginning, we said we will drop the price dramatically, and there was only one way to do so. It was by provoking competition. And the only way to provoke competition when you have exclusive patent holder is to bring in generic copies of that drug. We wrote to the patent holder, that was beginning of 2000, to each of the patent holder, Glaxo, Boehringer, saying, we, no one of our client is able to afford your drug, so we intend to bring in generics. Please tell us if you would consider this as a patent infringement. And, of course, we were flooded by letter of answers saying this will be considered as a patent infringement.
So once they told you it would be a patent violation for you to import generic drugs, what did you do?
Well, we were first very nervous about it, but we decided that we would do it and we'll let the world know that we would do it. They didn't dare to sue us. They didn't dare to sue us because in the meantime, MSF and other groups, TAC here locally, and several groups in the United States, extremely active, like ACT UP and TAG, had made huge effort to explain the situation, to explain that there is no way the huge majority of people affected by AIDS will one day be treated if there is no access to generic, to bring the price down. And as a result, we were never, ever sued.
So where do you get the generics from?
Initially from Brazil, because we wanted to get them from a state-controlled company that could give us. We wanted to make sure they would be at costing price. And the only one who accepted to give us the breakdown of price was a Brazilian. So we imported from Brazil. And as a result, it costed us exactly for a triple therapy, $1.08 per day. So it makes it more or less 360, a bit more, 360 per year, down from $6,000. You see the difference?
That's per person.
Per person, yes.
Yeah, very big difference.
It's a big difference, definitely. Nowadays, we have worked on different other scenario. We still import some from Brazil. We import some from India. The ultimate goal, of course, was to get a local production because we were convinced that it would certainly change the president's mind if instead of paying in U.S. dollars every month a huge check, because inevitably it would be a huge check, if this could be produced locally, paid in rand, and create jobs, it might change his mind. And as a matter of fact, as I'm speaking to you, it has started now. The first antiretroviral is produced here close to Port Elizabeth by a company called Aspen Pharmacare. And, of course, we use it.
I know that one of the biggest concerns about distributing antiretroviral drugs to people who are poor and uneducated is that they might have difficulty complying with the complicated regimen. There are several drugs you have to take in the AIDS antiretroviral regimen. They have to be taken at the same time every day. So what have some of the problems, have you had problems with compliance in the township in South Africa where you work?
Yes, we have had problem of compliance for the good reason that compliance is not an easy issue. But generally said, we have been completely surprised by the fact that the result we achieved here were, as a matter of fact, much better than everything you read published on court in the United States. Why so? The first reason is a social reason. We deal with a less problematic population. We deal in great majority with mothers, their child, their partners, who are trying, with difficulty of course, to build a family. We don't deal like in a large proportion in Western countries with IV drug users, with prostitutes. Here, HIV/AIDS, it's part of the environment. It's everybody. It's normal. So first reason, I would say a social reason. Second reason, people are very aware that they have an extraordinary chance to benefit from those drugs, and they won't have a second one. And I can tell you that they stick religiously to their treatment because they know very well, contrary to impression again we can have in the West, that if they miss that chance, they won't have another one. And the third reason is probably the most powerful. You know, the young generation in Europe doesn't see anymore their peers, their friend, their colleague dying. Here, I can tell you, people still die on a daily basis. The main activity is to go to a funeral every single Saturday. So they know very well each time one brings someone in terminal stage in the waiting room, like it happened again this morning, everybody look at each other and say, I'm going to take my pills. So I think that's what's making the difference.
My guest is Dr. Eric Gomar, and he's Doctors Without Borders head of mission in South Africa, where he set up a clinic to treat people with HIV/AIDS. You estimate that about 25% of the population in the township where you work is HIV positive. A lot of people are dying of AIDS where you are. Do you see the evidence of that in day-to-day life?
Oh, for sure. You see this evidence in the fact that this township is, for the moment, getting poorer and poorer. HIV strikes mainly the middle-aged population, the economically active. Once you have someone sick in your family, the African tradition forces you to take care of the sick. And whatever means you have, you are obliged to give all your means for the sick. So, I mean, we are surrounded by people on a daily basis. I have certainly 10 or 15 people coming to collect money for the funerals of this or to pay the drugs of that one. It has completely changed the life of a township. And as a result, you see kids dropping from school. You see nurses stopping their job so that they can get what they call a package. It means their pension money to be able to pay for drugs for their partner or for the children who are sick.
I don't know where else you've worked for Doctors Without Borders, but have you ever been surrounded by as much death as you've seen in the township of South Africa where you're based?
Yes, because I've worked for 22 years with the MSF, so I've seen more dramatic war situation like in Chechnya or refugee situation like in Kisangani or Eastern Congo, where I've counted a much higher number of dead. But there's a big difference. When you have in the morning dozens of deaths on the ground, in fact, you don't know them. So you are not shocked the same way. When you deal with HIV/AIDS patients, you know all of them because they are chronic patients. They come regularly, and each death is much more difficult to assume.
How are you personally dealing with all the deaths that you're seeing, deaths in many cases of people who you know?
Of course, I have ups and downs, like every single caregiver. We have a very strong team, a team made out of counselors, nurses, and a few doctors. In fact, we have three clinics here in Khayelitsha. We've known individuals, a lot of individuals who have passed away. They're always young, less than 20 years most of the time, looking at you in the hope you're going to save them. And then, well, when you don't succeed, of course, you feel suddenly extremely lonely and ashamed. But the best way to cope with it is share it with the team, and that's what we do.
Do you have a lot of people who come to you hoping that they could get treatment, but their AIDS is too advanced to be helped by the antiretrovirals?
Yes. It's very common because now the rumor has spread, and we have people who traveled hundreds of kilometers. Last week, the young lady who had traveled, I've calculated, 1,800 kilometers. She was weighing 32 kilos and most probably TB, totally out of breath, totally anemic. She was literally dying on the table. She had done that in desperate, and you imagine the condition of transport. She had done in despair 1,800 kilometers because she thought that's the only place where she could be saved. And she passed away the same night.
That must have been rough. Did she have family with her?
Yes, her mother was with her.
So then her mother had to make that long trip back alone.
Yes, unfortunately. But I would say to that, that never, since I've been working here, never felt any sense of anger against us.
Mm-hmm.
We mourn that death with the mother, and, you know, she looked at me and said, well, we, in her words, of course she wasn't speaking English, but some things like, we have done what we could. And, you know, the huge majority of people living with HIV in this country, and again, there are 5 million, do not expect to be saved. In fact, a lot of them know very well that they will not be saved because this is almost an impossible task. But people are extremely sensitive, and all what they want in the name of what they fought for under apartheid, their definition nowadays of democracy, like Nelson Mandela was saying in a concert Saturday, is to be given a right to be seen, to be treated. As long as you have tried, and tried with all your means to do something, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But if you haven't tried, you are not entitled to be part of that democracy.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and good luck with your program.
It was a pleasure, and thank you for your interest.
Dr. Eric Gomar is the head of mission in South Africa for Doctors Without Borders. He spoke to us from Cape Town. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. We're closing with a recording by the Cuban pianist Ruben Gonzalez. He died Monday at the age of 84. Gonzalez was one of the older Cuban jazz musicians who were considered old-fashioned after the revolution. His career was revived and he became popular in America as a result of Rye Cooter's 1999 documentary, The Buena Vista Social Club.